In today's podcast, I talk to legendary British makeup artist and director of artistry for MAC Cosmetics, the one and only Mr. Turner.
I'm Louise Duffy, and this is the Brown Palmas Podcast.
Terry is one of the brand's most colourful, fashionable and creative ambassadors. His work regularly features in publications like Harper's Bazaar, Dazed and Confused, ID, GQ and many, many more. And he can frequently be found backstage at international fashion collections. In fact, I'm catching Terry just ahead of London Fashion Week, where he will work on runway shows for Richard Quinn, Roland Murray, JW Anderson, Preen and Roxanda. Since the 80s, Terry has regularly collaborated with some of fashion and music's most influential names, working on music videos for the likes of Grace Jones, George Michael and Kylie Minogue, and advertising campaigns for Alexander McQueen, Vivienne Westwood and many more. So, welcome to the Brown Palmas Podcast, Terry Barber.
Thank you very much.
We are in your buildings in 1 Fitzroy and it is beautiful. It's perfect for brands that live here, like especially MAC. It's amazing here.
Yeah, it's like a little nest, isn't it? With all these different brands in it.
Yeah.
A little hub.
144,000 square foot of lip gloss.
Shut up.
It's a good spot to be, isn't it? But come here, do people train here as well? Does everything happen here?
Yeah, they have everything here. They have marketing, PR.
Yeah.
And then they have floors where they have all the training rooms for the different brands. So it's pretty, you know, it's pretty contained.
It is.
Everything about the brands goes on here.
Here, okay. You know. And in terms of training for a brand like MAC, what does that entail? You know, you don't just rock up to the counter. Like, what does it entail? What do you want your makeup artist to know when they're ready to get on the counter?
It's funny. I mean, I used to be a trainer at MAC. I went through a period where I was a trainer.
Well, you've done it all at MAC.
I've pretty much had my finger in every pie.
You have.
What I used to do is kind of, for me, the main thing about being a makeup artist, whether you work for a brand or not, is being able to, like, communicate with people.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you have to talk it as well as walk it. I've always stood by that.
And people come to you and they have different wants, and you could have, like, you know, a frazzled mom of five kids or a teenager who's just starting out and, you know, filling this makeup bag. So yeah, you need to understand them, don't you?
And I agree with that. And I've never really kind of been into giving people false promises about makeup.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as you said, if someone has 5 minutes to do their makeup in the morning, that's the advice you should be giving them.
Yeah.
Not showing them a picture of a celebrity who's been worked on for 2 hours.
I know.
And say, you need to aspire to this.
Yeah.
Actually, you know, those people who do that five-minute makeup in the morning are the people I admire the most.
Yeah.
Those are my inspirations.
Yeah. And I mean, that's increasingly the way we live now. Like, you know, you're doing your makeup on the tube or like on the school run.
My favourite.
I love that.
Transport makeup is my favourite.
I know.
I watch girls on the bus because I get the bus to work in the morning. They get the makeup bag out on the lap in their own world.
But I love that time of the day.
Yeah.
That, like, it is, there's something special about having 5 minutes. So I have a little girl now and life is crazy. But like those 5 minutes that you're just like, close the door and I'm just doing my face. It's amazing what difference it makes to your day.
Yeah.
If you get those 5 minutes, whether it's on the tube or whatever it is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's working it out, isn't it? I mean, that's what I like about my, I admire people who've worked it out, who aren't kind of a slave to it. You know, it's like, oh, I have to have 2 hours and I have to admire myself in the mirror.
Yeah.
It's like, right, I've got 5 minutes. I'm going to put this product around my eye and like stick my finger in it and smudge it.
Yeah.
And I know how little or how much to get away with.
Yeah.
I don't have to have it perfect.
That comes with age too, doesn't it? I think, you know,
Knowledge,
and when you start out and you're doing your face, like, I remember the days when it would take me an hour to get ready. And now you're like, God, if I had that time, I'd be doing a lot more.
We had that time when we were young.
Yeah, you just, and you give it to yourself, when you're young.
And I think that's when you were more focused on transforming yourself.
Yes.
And there's a difference between transforming yourself, which is what you tend to do when you're young and experimental.
Yeah.
And then later on in life, you just want to make yourself look better.
And enhance what you have.
And I think, you know, going back to that training question, it's having people aware of the differences in the motivations that people have to put makeup on. Not everybody wants a transformation.
No. And I think that MAC is one of those brands that people go to for all of those needs. Like when you start out, MAC, when I started buying makeup, MAC was the makeup to have, and it still is for me.
Yeah.
So you're kind of, you're growing with, or your customers are growing and still, you know, finding all of their needs are met in MAC. So that's, you know, that's a sign of the inclusivity of your brand, which is amazing.
Well, I think it dealt with people's identities. Mm. It didn't give them a brand look. Mm-hmm. It didn't have pictures of like supermodels hanging above the counter.
Yeah.
And, you know, to tell people you have to look like this.
Yeah.
It kind of took people's lives and took their personalities and their characters, and it kind of put it into a makeup design that was designed for them.
Mm-hmm.
It gave them all the possibilities of what they could do with makeup rather than dictating a look.
Yeah. Cause and it went across everybody, and it does go across everybody. There's no, you know, we talk about the inclusivity, which is so important to the makeup industry. And now brands are catching up and they have their many, many shades of foundation. Yeah. But like Studio Fix always had such a huge range, like 60 plus probably now, is it?
Yeah, I mean, all the brands are banner waving now, aren't they? They kind of add some darker shades to their collection, and then they sit back and
go, wow, look
bask
at us.
In their own self-righteousness and think, we nailed it.
Yeah.
And it's not, it's not about that. It has to go much further than that.
Yeah.
You know, I always say to those brands who just do those extra tones of foundations, what about the concealer? What about the contour? What about the eyebrow pencil? What about the lip line?
And MAC has always done that, but
quietly. Yeah, it's always been an unspoken thing with MAC. That's what they did right from the beginning.
Mm.
You know, whatever you want to do with makeup, you can do with MAC, I think was the original mantra.
It's amazing.
And that's always stood. And, you know, when it comes to diversity, I think it's suddenly turned into numbers as well, isn't it? There's these kind of comparisons of, oh, we do this many foundations, you do that many foundations.
Yeah.
It's more than that. I think with MAC's range of skin tones, you know, foundation colors, that's been really carefully curated over many years.
Yeah.
You know, we started off with, say, 10 shades.
Yeah.
For instance, Face and Body Foundation, the Legend.
Yeah.
We started off with about 12 shades in that. But I think as MAC's grown and it opened in more continents around the globe, we found out that a lot of those continents have much more kind of specific needs in terms of undertone.
The undertones and the cool and the warm.
The cool and the warm.
Yeah.
You know, more people with mixed race heritage, you know, people wanting different styles of the way they wear makeup on the face. You know, people wanting more transparency or people wanting more coverage. There are all these little aspects of like skin tone, skin color, and desired finish and desired effects. So it's been really carefully curated over decades. It's not about all of a sudden, boom, we're going to put out 60 shades because it's a big number.
Yeah, and it's that kind of quiet integrity, I think it is, you know, that MAC has, that I just think that's why we keep coming back to it, and that's why it's beloved for generations among people, you know, for decades. Yeah. Like, I mean, I'm using it for 2 decades now.
Yeah.
And Viva Glam is another sign of that. You know, I was just reading the figures, and we're not talking about numbers, but the money that that has raised for HIV and AIDS causes over the last 25 years last year, actually.
25 years,
half a billion.
Yeah.
But there's no one shouting about it, really. It's quite an understated contribution, really.
Yeah, well, originally it started because we wanted to give something back to the community that MAC was born out of. You know, it was kind of, it was people, it was fashion industry, it was the entertainment industry, it was subcultures. So as well as kind of raising money for people living with HIV and AIDS, I think it went further than that. For me, it was all about the outsiders.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
The people who were really drawn to the brand, it felt about them. Even though it was an HIV AIDS charity, it felt more about like the bands of outsiders and the subculture kids and, you know, people who have always existed a little bit on the outside.
Yeah.
That's what Viva Glam feels like to me, rather than just a charity. It feels like a community. It feels like a spirit.
I know, and you get the best people to contribute to it, like RuPaul and like even names like Sia, and there's just a constant stream of people who want to be a part of this because it is something special.
Yeah, well, people know? Who's Imagery has kind of changed things.
Yeah.
Maybe they've kind of inspired generations, mm-hmm. or they've made a sort of a specific change purely through the way they look.
Yeah. Icons.
Yeah, icons. Yeah.
Like Pamela Anderson, she was in Brian Thomas for it, and RuPaul was too.
I did Pamela Anderson's makeup actually when she was in
Brian Thomas. Yeah. Oh, I mean, people still talk about it.
Yeah.
There was this little guy who came in and got a picture with her, and he was on the front page of the news, and he became an icon as a result of proximity to Pamela Anderson.
Yeah. Tottering in a grungy eyeliner and a hot pants.
Still got it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's talk about you then and how this all started. So you went to art school.
Yeah.
At what point did you move from the canvas to the face? At what point did you decide, I want to be a makeup artist?
I think immediately when I entered art school.
Yeah.
Because I went to art school in South Wales, because I'm from South Wales originally. Yeah. And the first day I walked into art school, I basically, what I had in front of me was loads of people who were from all the subcultures at the time.
Yeah.
They were punks, they were goths, they were rockabillies, they were psychabillies, mm-hmm. new romantics. It was just like this banquet of subcultures.
Yeah.
And I actually thought, rather than the art, the formal art training, I'm more interested in this.
Yeah.
You know, people were dressing according to their music. Mm-hmm. Like whatever music you listened to, you joined that tribe.
Isn't that amazing?
It was pretty amazing.
What music were you listening to then?
A mixture of kind of, you know, a little bit of punk, a little bit of electronica. Pop was quite interesting then, do you know what I mean? Because pop was kind of very homemade and DIY.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you spoke before about David Bowie and, you know, his ability to kind of blur boundaries and, you know, experiment with gender and his look. Like, so there were people who inspired you like that.
Yeah. And I think if you look at someone like Bowie, I'm really seeing that that legacy has been continued now.
Yeah.
Because what I'm loving about the moment we're in is that there's this movement of people not committed to the gender that they've been assumed that they should have, mm-hmm. you know, not aspiring to a sort of alpha male or alpha female gender.
It's so empowering. And you can imagine, you know, what it must be like when that wasn't okay. And, you know, for somebody as brave as Bowie to, you know, to play with that when nobody else was.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, we took the punches for it back in the day.
I know. Yeah. I know. It was tough. You know, but, you know, so you found yourself in that space that you're like, okay, I'm going to focus on the aesthetic, the personal aesthetic of the people you're looking at. And so then you applied for a grant to the Prince's Trust.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So do you think your career could have evolved the way it did had you not had that?
Probably not, because I'm a working class background.
Yeah.
I had no money.
Yeah.
I had no funding. And it was funny, when I saw the Prince's Trust, I had no business plan at all. I hadn't written any story. I was this kind of scrawny, punky kid with strange hair. But I just, I guess the way I talked about what I wanted to do, you know, they took a chance on me and gave me quite a minimal grant to do like a little makeup course in London.
Yeah. But how that paid off?
Well, that was just the first rung on a long ladder, but I think without that, I wouldn't have been able to. It was quite elitist at the time, you know, fashion and makeup.
Mm.
It was only available, really, to people who were quite privileged.
Yeah. So it was great. So you did, what was the course that you took from there then?
I did a foundation course in art and design at Gwent College of Higher Education in Newport, South Wales.
Mm-hmm.
No tables and chairs. It was an old warehouse. It was really grungy. It was quite great. Then I started, I think I realized halfway through that I didn't really want to paint or do graphics or anything as a career.
Mm-hmm.
I was more interested in styling and the way people looked.
Yeah.
I did start a degree at interior design. Don't ask me why.
But it's all creativity, you know, and you kind of have to dabble in a few to realize the one that you're the best at. So then Mac. Okay, so you started in Mac.
Well, there was a period in between, actually, where I just went to clubs.
Good. Okay. And that's the college of life.
I gave up formal education, lived in cheap bedsits, made our own clothes and our own styling, went to clubs, lived in the underground.
Oh, my God.
Had jobs, got fired from jobs.
Oh, that sounds fun, though. Probably, you know, there's a struggle in that, but, like, ultimately that sounds...
10 years of being an outlaw and a club rat. And
I love that.
Which I loved about when I moved to London. That really excited me. You know, it was the kind of concrete jungle anonymity.
And you have to do that for a while.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And in terms, so when you were hitting the clubs like that, like, were you experimenting with makeup? Were you trying it out on other people?
More on my own face at the time, because I had no subject matter to try it on.
Okay.
But more on my own face. But, you know, those kind of...
I want to see pictures of that.
Yeah, we didn't have cameras at the time.
Which is safer for everybody, right? God, we can't get away with anything now.
Yeah, I think it was those kind of hedonistic years, you know, where you cared about nothing other than going out, what you're going to wear.
Yeah.
We didn't have any money usually, so how am I going to get in and how am I going to get home?
Yeah.
And how am I going to buy drinks? I'll probably have to steal them. It's a bit of a skill at the time.
Yeah, it's a handy one to have.
But those years were almost like a university degree to me, because they taught me about style and subculture.
And do you think that, like, back then, would you ever have imagined that, you know, you're in a club, you're listening to Grace Jones, George Michael, that you would then be working with icons like that? Have there been, like, there has to have been so many pinch me moments when you're like, wow, here I am, you know?
Like, yeah, I mean, working with Grace Jones is one of them, because actually all the album covers she did with the photographer Jean-Paul Goud, I used to stick them up on my wall in my bedroom when I was young. And I actually ended up shooting with Grace Jones and Jean-Paul Goud.
Oh, my God.
Which was, that was incredible.
That has to be just that, like, I mean, crazy surreal moment.
Surreal.
Yeah. And there were so many then thereafter, and we'll talk to them. But I suppose back to when you started in MAC then, you started as a makeup artist, you know, in a department store.
On counter.
And then, you know, fast forward a few years, now you are the director of artistry.
Yes.
So what does that mean? What's your day like?
My day, it's different every day.
Of course.
How lucky I am to work at MAC is that I can still kind of work as a makeup artist.
Yes.
And the makeup artist that I dreamed of being when I was young.
That you haven't been lost to the corporate world because of your position.
No. Mm. Well, and I always determined, even working for MAC, I'm still going to be a makeup artist.
Good.
You know, I'm still going to go out and do magazine covers.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of no one did that for me. I just went and did it myself.
Yeah.
I think I was a little, my kind of punk mentality kicked in a little bit and thought, you know what, just because I work for a brand, don't think I'm a different type of makeup artist. I'm still the same. This is what I need to do to pay my rent.
But you couldn't be the director of artistry you are if you weren't doing that, I would assume, you know, because that's where you're learning. And even like Fashion Week, so many products are born backstage. You know, you have to continue to be a makeup artist.
Yeah. And you have to be really aware. You have to have a 360 on like makeup and beauty culture, how it relates to fashion, how it relates to real people. You know, I mean, it is a culture. It's not just a kind of series of lines and shades that you put on someone's face. It's not just technical.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole world around it.
Yeah.
And I think working at MAC has given me a real 360 and quite a helicopter view as well. I think people who just work in fashion, who possibly only work on models, they don't have the view that someone who's worked for a brand has.
Yeah, okay. To get to know who you're working for, or like, you know, that your client essentially,
Yeah, and also, you know, the fact that none of us would have jobs if people didn't want to go to a makeup counter and buy makeup.
That's the grassroots, right?
Yeah, if people don't want to buy it and use it and experience it, then none of us will have jobs.
Mm.
So yeah, it keeps you grounded.
It does. And then the parts that probably don't keep you so grounded, you're jetting around the world then for fashion weeks here, there and everywhere.
Yeah.
So we vicariously enjoy the fashion weeks on Instagram, you know, and you get to see a little bit of the intensity of backstage. But what is it like when you are backstage and you've got a show like, for example, Roland Murray coming up in London Fashion Week? What's that like?
I think when it comes to backstage at a fashion show, I always call it, it's like about 50 cooks working on one meal.
Oh, wow.
You know, because basically it's models walking down a runway in clothes, looking amazing in order to inspire people to wear those clothes.
Mm.
The work that goes into that backstage is really intense and really crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always found, I've always tried to keep myself quite calm in that situation.
Yeah.
I think sometimes it's the people not working who are more crazy. Yeah. Like these days.
The people's people?
Yeah, you lift up a brush and people want to do a boomerang on it.
Yeah.
Know, for no reason.
Oh, it's exhausting.
You know, lots of people taking pictures of their sandwiches for Instagram. And, yeah. You know, it's like some big crazy marketplace.
I know.
But when I'm backstage, I like the technical aspects of mm-hmm. it. It's where I've learned a lot of my craft of makeup.
Yeah.
Because it teaches you to work really quickly.
Yeah.
And being a quick makeup artist is probably one of the most underestimated skills you can have.
I think so, because we talked about that time, you know, and you know, sometimes if you go and get your makeup done and they're like, yeah, I'll just take an hour and 20, and you're like, oh, like it's hard to sit still for that long. And I would imagine backstage there's just no time for that.
No, and sometimes, and you know, it taught me I can do makeup at the same time as hair.
Oh,
with someone's head moving. Yeah. Not, you know, you have to.
Yeah. You have to be part of that.
Someone's putting their boots on, someone's painting their nails, someone's mm-hmm. backcombing their hair, and you're painting their face. And you basically have to get it done.
Okay.
And that's real skills.
And what about the collaborative process with the designer then? Mm. Because it's up to you to bring their story to life, essentially, you know? And say, for example, London Fashion Week is coming up now, and actually, Brand Thomas are going along with Mac, and there's some amazing names like Roland Murray, J.W. Anderson, Richard Quinn, Roxanda. They are of some very disparate aesthetics. So how do you know, you're using the same products, and I know Loud and Clear, the new limited edition, is going to be a big one for you in this London Fashion Week. But how do you bring their aesthetic, or their story rather, to life when they're all so different?
Well, you have to listen to, the designer telling a story of who they are, how they want people to feel when they wear their clothes, what their aesthetic is. There's a lot of listening.
Mm.
I mean, it's not about going in gung-ho and thinking I'm going to give them the most technically amazing makeup you've ever had. It's so nuanced, and there's so many kind of different little moods and subtleties.
Uh-huh.
Even if you're doing something which looks like no makeup.
Yes, the no makeup trend.
Well, like for someone like J.W. Anderson, it's never a big makeup show, but maybe the face is kind of tweaked in some way that suggests a certain kind of mood of the person wearing those clothes.
Which do you prefer? So if J.W. Anderson wants that very pared back minimal look, and Mac are doing it so well right now, you know, the dewy, it's a very fresh look. And then in some shows, I'm sure it's all about this creativity and this vibrant color and, you know, all of that kind of thing. Which do you rather working on?
I would treat each one of those with exactly the same kind of technical skill. I would give them all the same thought, the same kind of detail, the same nuance.
And so for Fashion Week then, so when you're heading, you know, and it's so intense, the process of it from Milan to London to New York, how do you live then? Do you get to chill out? Do you have favorite restaurants that you go to? Which is your favorite city to visit?
I think I love Paris.
Yeah. It's the one, isn't it?
Well, because I think with Paris, it's the heritage of Paris, isn't it? And you can feel it.
Yeah.
Like it feels really important.
Mm.
And I always feel no matter what's happened in the other cities, when you get to Paris, that's going to tell you the real story.
The real story of what we can see.
I don't know. I guess it is such an establishment there, isn't it?
Mm.
But I don't know. Somehow in Paris and fashion are pretty synonymous, aren't they?
Absolutely.
Like it feels that you really need to up your game in Paris.
Yeah. And so how, like, is it something that you have to plan towards, even for your own packing and traveling? You know, like, is it something that you're working towards? Okay, so this is the intense moment of your calendar. How do you prepare for it?
Well, now in the Mac team, you have to prepare yourself that you might be hungover quite a lot.
Good.
Time.
I'm happy to hear
There's
that.
Something about working on shows. It's the intensity of it.
You like need to let loose afterwards.
Your brain is fried. Usually it's kind of hotel lobby bar.
Good.
And we all just sit around and talk about the day and talk about what's pissed us off.
Yeah.
Talked about what we loved.
Good.
So we're, you know, it's not like we're going out and being very fashionable when we're doing shows and going to restaurants.
Yeah.
Usually it's a hotel lobby bar situation and like you take the day off.
Good. That's good. Yeah. You need to do that.
Wind down.
Yeah. And you must be so tight then if you're all traveling together. Do you use the same team for every week?
Well, there's one big team and it gets kind of allocated to different shows. Mm. But it's lovely, actually. I mean, I've always felt really lucky to travel Mac doing shows.
Yeah.
You know, because you've got that little kind of family environment when you get back to the hotel.
And you get to know people better when you travel with them, don't you?
Yeah.
And so then we mentioned Loud and Clear. This is the new limited edition, which is about to launch. Tell me a little bit about that then, and what goes into creating a limited edition collection?
Well, Mac is very about limited edition collections, which some people get annoyed when they have fabulous products and they get discontinued. The reason Mac do that is because we've always kind of wanted to work like a fashion brand.
Yeah.
We've never
seasons.
Yeah, seasons. Mm. We've never really wanted the brand to stand still.
Okay.
You know, we've always wanted it to be constantly moving.
Yeah.
You know, new technology, new color trends, new, you know, micro trends.
Yeah. And do you tend to keep probably the, you know, if you find something in a limited edition that is just such a hit, do you try and incorporate it then into a more stable product?
A lot of things can be reintroduced. You know, they maybe kind of go back into a sort of library and sort of brought back out again because all trends are kind of... go full circle.
Yeah.
You know, for instance, at the moment, like Loud and Clear, for instance, really feels like Mac returning to its roots of the 90s.
The lip gloss almost. And like the shine and, you know, you know.
But also, you know, those kind of really bricky red colours and rusts that Mac was really famous for in the beginning, which were quite unusual when they first came out.
Okay.
It's like colours like, you know, chili lipstick or Marrakesh.
Yes. And is that the earthier, that's to create that more natural, earthier look? Or is that the hope for that? Or is that why you've gone back to those colours?
Well, there's that whole kind of like earth tone feel, slightly kind of 90s.
Yeah.
Or almost a bit kind of sports luxe. Mm-hmm. But there's these kind of mixture of these brights in it. Like there's this amazing kind of brick red in it.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember like sort of like Helmut Lang shows in the 90s.
Yes.
You know, like those really bare scrubbed faces and then the sharp brick lip.
I know. I love that.
Or sort of, you know, Kate Moss in the Johnny Depp years.
Yeah.
You know, Noah's World, that really brick red lipstick and a natural.
And it's easy for that. That's one of those ones. You know, it's hard to get a red that suits everyone. But those more earthier tones, they work more gently, I suppose, with your skin tones, do they?
Yeah, and there's something almost kind of slightly more cool and effortless. Mm. I mean, a pillar box red is quite glamour, isn't it? It's quite serious. Yeah. It's like a mean business.
Yeah, don't mess with me when I've got my Ruby Woo on. Yeah. Back off.
You know, I'm either doing style or I'm doing sophistication or I'm doing sex.
Yeah,
no.
But I mean business with all three.
But whereas there's something about a brick or a rust red, which is kind of more sort of playful.
Yeah.
You know, effortless. It reminds me of kind of, do you remember Drew Barrymore in the 90s as
well?
You know?
Yes.
Which she did kind of rosy cheeks, but she did a brick red.
Lovely, yeah.
I'm liking all these kind of, it's not just kind of bringing back colours or bringing back trends. I think it's bringing back moments from other decades.
That's lovely to remember them that way, isn't it?
Yeah. I get accused of being nostalgic quite a lot.
Well, I think we all are. I mean, fashion is built on nostalgia and the throwback. It's so important.
Well, you need to recycle it.
Yeah, everything isn't it?
I think ideas should be, like the past is there. The ideas of the past are there to be recycled.
They worked for a reason.
Yeah. Mm. You know, it's like how Amy Winehouse did soul music.
Yeah.
You know, kind of took a classic sound, recycled it.
And just made it her own, yeah.
And then just brought it back in this almost kind of punk jazz way. Yeah. You know, I mean...
That's a great way to look at it, though. That's true. And that goes across all industries.
Yeah.
For you, then, as director of artistry, then, what's your contribution to the process of the limited edition or maybe the Mac maker where you're getting an influencer, perhaps, to create their own individual lipstick? It's Sarah Chapman is the next, is she?
Sam Chapman is the next, excuse me. Sam and Nick actually both done lipsticks.
Fab.
And they're completely different.
Mm.
But I look at them and I can see Sam and I can see Nick in the colour.
And so so in terms of the actual creation of, say, the limited edition or the Mac maker, are you overseeing it? Are you saying, let's go this way, or like what? As director of artistry,
I didn't really have a hand in Mac Maker because that was basically Mac's collaboration with those influences.
Yes, of course.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas actually, I actually did the campaign shoot for Loud and Clear.
Yes.
And actually, I had this lovely little pixie-like girl who looked a bit like Twiggy.
Lovely.
And I did big rust eyes and a rust red lip on her.
Yeah. Fabulous.
Yeah, I don't actually design the products, but I know when we do shows every season, we usually get a prototype bag of products. Mm. And then we kind of go forth and utilize them. And then we give a lot of feedback on them.
And some products then are born in those backstage moments, right? Like a powder kiss.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't test backstage.
Okay.
That would be illegal.
Right. Yes. Okay.
The product's already tested for safety. And regulation.
Yeah. It's important, isn't it? With those pretty faces you're dealing with. Yeah.
But it's just that we kind of test them for their style relevance and whether how people react to them. And, you know, it's how kind of new technologies are kind of working on the job, if you like. It's a great testing ground.
And in terms of products, then let's talk products. Mm. So there are very few makeup bags in Ireland. They wouldn't have either, you know, strobe cream or maybe a spice lip liner or Studio Fix, one of them in it.
Yeah.
What are the products that you are reaching for most regularly?
Well, I work a lot on camera.
Yeah.
I do a lot of editorial, and face and body foundation is, I wouldn't be without it.
Okay.
And I've tried a lot of other foundations. I've occasionally crept away and tried something else, and I always come back to face and body.
Yeah.
For me, it's like real skin, but better skin, and shines in all the right places.
Okay.
Like, it just works every time for me, face and body foundation.
Do you find there are other products then that will probably, you know, will look good on the catwalk, but may not photograph as well?
Yes.
Yeah, so you just have to be so aware of every single thing.
But sometimes what photographs really well also works well for real life.
Yeah.
Because often what photographs well works really well in daylight, for instance.
If somebody was starting to build their makeup kit, what is so the product you just mentioned would be the key, but are there any other ones that you say, okay, like that's going to get you from A to Z and morning to night?
Yeah, I mean, things like face and body, matte lipstick.
Yeah.
My lifelong ambition is to have the smallest kit ever.
Right.
So I actually only carry a range of matte lipsticks at the moment because if I want different textures, I can make them.
Okay.
Like you take a matte lipstick and you mix it with a bit of lip balm, you've got a sheer lipstick.
There you go.
Or you can gloss a matte lipstick and it's like Studio 54, you know.
Okay.
So matte lipstick, a good range of basic pencils because I'm a huge, I love Kohl.
Yeah.
It's one of my all-time favorite products.
Yeah.
Because I love the idea of putting Kohl around the eye and they're just rubbing it.
It's fabulous, especially under the eye. Yeah.
When it melts into the skin.
Yeah.
It's kind of sexy and grungy.
But it's
and
a
cool.
thin line, isn't it, before it goes a little bit too far down.
Yeah.
For the real woman, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. But that real woman who loves that knows when to come in and fix it.
Top up.
As we talked about knowing before, that's one of those places of knowing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm going to let this melt underneath my eye because I quite like that whole kind of pammy grunge type of thing. But there's some point when it's going to make me look exhausted.
Exhausted, absolutely.
So I'm going to go in and fix it.
What about brushes then? You know, in terms of you and you're creating this perfect look, do you always go for the brush or do you blend with your hands or a sponge? What's
your
favorite?
It's always a mixture.
Yeah.
There's always a mixture of a tool and fingertips.
Mm.
To me, I don't know how anybody can do makeup without using fingertips at some point.
I think it's a crossover point in, you know, for me and, you know, my friends, you know, there was a point when you're like, okay, now I need to start investing in my brushes. But prior to that, when you're younger, perhaps, and when you're just, it's all about the product. But to invest in brushes is key, really, isn't it? And to have a good kit.
Yeah. Well, you can get away with two brushes for eyes. Mm-hmm. You know, if you really want to go basic.
Yeah.
Like I'm obsessed with an angle brush.
Yeah.
You know, the little sharp chisel
shaped
angle brush.
For up or down.
You can do your lash line with that. And then you can also do your brows with that.
Yeah.
And then just simply a sort of dome shaped eyeshadow brush.
Yeah.
Something to kind of, you know, wash eyeshadow over an eyelid.
Yeah.
Because I'm not, in terms of makeup artistry, I'm not one who packs products on.
No.
I know there's a whole trend for that. And I know that the young people are quite interested in this. You know, we talked about transformation.
Yes.
They're loving the whole packing of product on.
Yeah.
Whereas for me, I'm more about you put product on and then you have to allow the skin to come up.
I think so. And I find the older I get, the less that looks good. You know what I mean? So if I'm packing it on, you can see every bit of it. You can see everything that I don't want you to see.
Yeah. Even when you're young, packed on is going to make you look old.
Yeah, it's not a good look for anyone. So your kit is quite compact then?
Yes.
Okay. That
it's
makes
not
it
as compact as it could be. I'm like, you know, I'm...
You're a work in progress.
I'm a work in progress, yeah.
What do you think of social media then and what that has done to the beauty industry? Because there are pros and cons, and the pros are like it has given us a new perspective and a platform for new, unique looks. Well, not necessarily new, but more unique beauty looks. But on the other hand, it seems that if somebody has a makeup brush and an iPhone, you can call yourself a makeup artist. Like, does that exhaust you?
It's a double-edged sword, isn't it? Social media. I mean, it allows anyone of any background to present their ideas to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's made it quite competitive. You know, especially with young people, you're always comparing yourself to someone you think's better.
It's hard.
It's led to lots of kind of feeling of inadequacy and anxiety.
Yeah, it's not healthy.
So with social media, I think I predict in the 2020s that people are going to start to master it more, as in it suddenly turned into something that's very kind of judgmental and generic.
Yeah.
It's all about brand sponsorships and partnerships.
And what's authentic then, if that's the case, you know?
Whereas in fact, it is such a beautiful way of sharing information.
Do you feel we've gone so far that we now need to, as you say, hone it back and master it a little bit more? Because like I say, if you're seeing 10 products by 10 influencers, where is the real taste and I suppose integrity coming out there, you know?
Yeah. Well, also because everything's about going for big numbers, isn't it?
Yeah.
And when it's all about numbers, then it's just going to lead to mediocrity.
Yeah.
So if a celebrity face creates big numbers, that's all you're going to see. Or, you know, if a Kardashian contour, for instance, gives you the best numbers, everyone's going to do a Kardashian contour. So it's doing nothing for the future of style, really.
And in terms of the artistry of your craft, do you think that that's getting lost in the YouTube tutorials of somebody who's just maybe started doing it a little while ago, but all of a sudden they have those numbers?
Yeah, I mean, the whole tutorial thing was great. You know, people are far more educated about makeup than they used to be.
Yeah.
They know products. They know how to apply makeup. I think the trouble is it's created something a bit generic. It's created a right and wrong.
Yeah.
And it's also created an ideal.
Okay.
Which to me is really unhealthy when there's an ideal.
Yeah. MAC was never about the ideal.
No.
Never,
not
ever.
At all.
Yeah.
I don't think social media is a place for people to have flaws or make mistakes or create beautiful accidents, which is what style is, isn't it?
Yeah. And there's such a skewed version of beauty now that you can face tune and filter the hell out of yourself. We don't know what's real anymore.
No.
So do you think then, well, I guess so, if there was an aspiring makeup artist, I know you said before that the social media side of it is actually 2%.
Yeah.
What's the 98%? What are the key things in there that they should focus on more?
Being able to storytell about beauty.
Yeah.
You know, being able to talk about it, being able to talk about its heritage and its history and how that relates to now. Because I think, you know, with makeup, you have to kind of wrap a little bit of seduction around it.
Yeah.
You know, you can't just say black eyeliner is going to look good on you. But you could talk about, you know, let's take it back to the 90s a little bit and make it smudge it out and then come up with some references for what that is.
Yeah.
You know, so you need to, I think.
You go that direction, do it and like it and then bring in the references there? Or do you go references and then create the look?
You know, focus on that person first.
Yeah,
what it
is
they desire.
Yeah.
How it is they want to feel.
Yeah.
Very few people in makeup talk about emotions. They just talk about technical.
Yeah.
You know, they just talk about, oh, look at my perfect flicked eyeliner, which is more perfect and more flicked than everybody else's. But no one's actually talking to the wearer of that flicked eyeliner, mm-hmm. who actually might want that eyeliner a bit more imperfect, yeah. and then they feel a bit cooler.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, one person's perfect is another person's kind of
nightmare.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. Theatrical.
Yeah. In terms of, so I have to, because I have such a genius in front of me, I have to do a quick fire and get as much information as you are, get as much information as you can, as I can out of you. So, your own skincare and grooming routine then, how are you still about like trying to be as succinct as possible when you're looking after yourself?
No, I mean, half of my face is beard.
Yeah. It's so easy for you.
But there's a lot of bald head. A lot of cleaning and exfoliating and yeah. peeling.
And are there any particular products that you love?
I'm quite basic, actually. I like peels.
Yeah.
There's one by The Ordinary that I use. It's like an AHA one.
Okay.
Is AHA the right one? I'm so terrible
with it. Oh, don't ask me. I'm asking you.
like a bit of an acid peel, and I use that like twice a week.
All over. On yeah. not, the beard.
Not on the bald head, because I wet shave my head.
Okay.
So I don't need to exfoliate it.
There you go. You've got that covered.
And a bit of, I still have a bit of La Mer moisturizer.
Oh, you can't beat it.
No.
Yeah.
But I've gone to the kind of soft lotion rather than the hard cream.
The heavy cream, yeah.
That used to make me look like an egg.
Yeah, nice shine.
Yeah.
Nice dewy glow when you use that, right?
Yeah.
If somebody, Mother's Day is around the corner, if somebody is looking for the perfect MAC gift, what might it be? That's how long is a piece of string there, really?
I think a really, an iconic MAC red lip.
Can you beat Ruby Woo?
You can't beat Ruby Woo, but there are options.
Yeah.
Like a chili. Mm-hmm. You know, we were talking about that whole kind of rusty,
yeah.
that kind of rust red.
Yeah.
Which I think is super cool again.
Do you think there's a universal red that suits everyone? Because, you know, I know there are blue tones that, you know, perhaps make your teeth look whiter. But
yeah.
is there one that works for every skin tone?
I don't think so.
No.
Because I don't get too scientific over red. Mm. When I advise people on red, like, you cannot judge a red until you put it on your face.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not, like, you can theorize about blue reds and orange reds and whatever mm. all you want. You put the red on, you look in the mirror, the right red will always make your skin look fresher. It'll
yeah.
always make your eyes look brighter.
Yeah.
And it'll make you feel the right way.
Mm-hmm.
For me, red is an emotional product to put on your face,
yeah,
and it's only you will know when you look in the mirror whether that emotion is correct or not,
yeah, whether it's the right one for you,
you know, because it's very it's a language, red lipstick.
Yeah,
it's not a theory, it's not a color theory.
No. I know we talked about your, you know, your surreal moments, and Grace Jones
yeah.
and Jean-Paul Goud being one of those. Mm. Are there any others? Because you've worked on such incredible campaigns with amazing faces and designers.
Yeah, I have. I mean, in terms of, I've got to work with some legends.
Yeah.
You know, we talked about Pamela Anderson. I worked with her for a few years.
Yeah.
And we even went to kind of around Europe, and I did really weird fridge adverts in Sweden
yeah.
with Pamela Anderson, which is the most weird thing ever. Mm-hmm. Great fun though. I think it's the kind of range of jobs I've had which is interesting. You know, it's everything from the top of mountains in the yeah. Alps for Tatler to the middle of deserts, you know.
What other job could give you that diversity?
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's really so it's more the kind of, as you said, the diversity of the jobs I've had, which mm. I found really interesting, rather than kind of one job over the other.
You're so lovely to talk to, and I think that's really important for a makeup artist, isn't
Thank
it?
You.
Because that's quite an intimate interaction, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you find that like...
I don't think it's something that I should necessarily be an expert of.
No.
Because I think everybody's an expert. I think people who use makeup and use it every day, they're experts. I'm yeah. the one who learns from them.
Yeah.
You know, I learn from the girl on that bus doing it in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, she's late for work. She's probably slightly hungover, but mm-hmm. she's like, I'm going to sort this out on my bus ride.
Yeah, yeah.
And she gets off looking great.
It's great. Yeah.
Like, she's the one that I'm learning from rather than me teaching her anything.
But even in terms of, you know, Pamela Anderson and like having that half an hour or whatever it is just in someone's yeah. face. Like
she taught me how to do a proper sexy but trashy eyeliner.
Yeah.
I always used to put eyeliner on, and she used to say, it's lovely eyeliner, but you need to trash it down a little bit.
Okay.
But, you know, it's that idea of customization that you learn.
Yeah.
And that's what I've learned over the years. It's not being able to do the most perfect line.
Yeah.
It's what you do afterwards with the line that makes it suit the person. And that can be either you take it apart, you destroy it, you rub a little bit out, or you smudge it in.
Yeah.
Or you let it melt into the skin. Those, to me, are all the makeup artist skills, not just the being able to draw the perfect line.
Yeah. That's such good advice for anybody who's entering or in this industry, you know, just to stand back and look at it and see what you need to do.
And you don't need to know those things straight away. I mean, an advice to make anybody wanting to be a makeup artist is, you know, take your time with that.
Yeah.
Because those things you gather along the way. You won't go to a makeup school and learn how to do customized eyeliner. You'll go to a makeup school and learn how to do perfect eyeliner.
Yeah.
It's up to you to discover those things afterwards.
Do you think there is an inherent instinct that you can't teach when it comes to that?
I think you can teach people a way of thinking where they kind of want to go and discover it themselves or find things out for themselves. Mm-hmm. I think you can teach a way of thinking, and I think you can teach kind of what goes where.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But you can't kind of, I mean, the rest of it is based on your own experiences and what you gather along the way and the little library that you put in your own head.
Yeah, it's very subjective.
Yeah.
We're at the start of 2020. What are you most looking forward to what are you most excited about in the year to come?
Oh, I'm not really that excited these days. I'm too old to be excited. I'm looking forward to just kind of continuing working.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not young anymore, and sometimes I think with creative industry, sometimes it's considered a young person's game. But sometimes. I still think I have a place.
Absolutely.
You know, and I'm actually, funnily enough, working with a lot of kind of new generation designers and photographers and stylists.
Do you learn a lot from them, probably?
I learn a lot from them. And they also get to tap into kind of maybe the 3 to 4 decades of style that I've experienced myself.
Yeah.
So I'm enjoying collaborating with a new generation.
That's
it's
amazing.
Not all great for a new generation. I think they've got a lot to fight for.
Do you think it's more difficult now, or was it when you were starting? It's a hard question, I know.
Well, I think now it's almost like you can suffer from a little bit too much knowledge.
Yeah.
I think, I don't know. I think young people have to reclaim their youth again.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is I think there's a moment in time where young people are going from child and having to go to adult straight away.
Yeah.
Even in the way they
look. There's not that club rap period that you enjoyed for 10 years, childhood, Nick and Drinks.
For me, childhood lasts till you're about 29.
Yeah. Oh, and it's terrible when you realise that it's over and you have to get on with it.
And I think you have to go out and make mistakes. You have to fuck up a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, you have to experiment with looks which are really bad, but you love them.
Yeah.
You know, I just think there are all sorts of things that you need to decide on for yourself before you're kind of successful or affluent or well put together or perfect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're a young person, you do not immediately have to look like a contestant from Love Island.
Oh.
That's a cartoon character.
Yeah.
Those are just inflatable people.
I hope it bursts, not the inflatables, but like that this kind of vision of like, you know, we're so exposed to now that we're not, you know, that it changes.
I have faith in the new generation.
I think so too. I hope that a touch of privacy and kind of being a little bit more elusive and a little bit more, you know, a little bit more mysterious. I hope that's to come.
Well, I mean, especially in Britain, for instance, I mean, post-Brexit, Britain is going to be interesting.
We'll see. That's only around the corner.
I'm kind of looking at it in a historical context. Last time we had that kind of moment was maybe the 70s and the 80s.
Yeah.
And that's when we got punk.
Yeah. Oh, wow. What could we get?
Maybe it's the time when things are a little bit bleak and people have a little less money and they're a bit angrier. I think that kind of suits.
Yeah.
I think it suits the UK and Ireland.
I think so, because we have to find our, you know, you have to get creative.
Yeah.
It's the only way to manage it.
And you have to make your own creativity.
Yeah.
And you have to make your own culture and your own world, like build your own universe.
Mm.
So I think when things are too easy, it's not creatively.
No.
conducive.
Not at all. Well, look, I you are such a busy man, and I've kept you for so long, and I just really appreciate your time.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
It is fascinating chatting to you, and we look forward to seeing what comes with Loud and Clear, and maybe you might come and see us in Brown Thomas soon.
Yeah, see you at Fashion Week.
Yes, I hope. Thank you so much. Thank you for listening to the Brown Thomas podcast. If you like what you heard, make sure to share and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And follow us on Official Brown Thomas on Instagram for more updates.